Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert, me today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries, and special guest, former pensions minister, and This Is Money pensions agony uncle, Steve Webb, which is a bit of a giveaway as to what is coming up today. A This Is Money investigation is continuing to uncover more women underpaid their state pension. Is it you? We'll let you know how to check. Plus, we turn our attention onto the impact of coronavirus on your pension, whether you have years left to save or you're taking your pension soon. Also, the Chancellor warns of a significant recession as Boris eases lockdown, the housing market gets the green light, and the furlough scheme gets extended. Shake it all together, and what do you have? Well, who knows, but Simon might have an idea. And of getting you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news, just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, for some time now, This Is Money has been investigating a government cock-up that's left an untold number of elderly women thousands of pounds poorer in retirement. In the past few weeks alone, our Tanya has discovered six more women who've been underpaid their state pension to the tune of around 22 grand over years. This is on top of two women who got back payments totaling 14,000 last month as a result of their investigation. And it's clear these are not the only cases. So, Steve, welcome. You first uncovered this via a question to your This Is Money pensions column. Tell us about that. How did this happen? How's it been allowed to happen?
Well, one of the things about writing the weekly column is that you find out what people don't understand about pensions, everything from private pensions and state pensions. And sometimes you come across things and think, that just doesn't look right. And what happened in this case is that there used to be a system whereby, this all sounds terribly old-fashioned because it's a system designed in the 1940s, but where the assumption was that married women were essentially financially dependent on their husbands. So as a concession, if you like, there was a rule which said if the husband has a basic state pension, then his wife, even if she hasn't paid full national insurance through her life, can claim 60% of his basic state pension when he reaches state pension age. That's the guts of it. And one by one, we've been discovering women who, in some cases for years, simply haven't been getting this amount, either because the government computer didn't make it happen when it should have done automatically, or for another group of women, because they actually needed to claim this uplift, they didn't know about it, and it never happened.
Can you gauge the extent of how many people might be affected by this, based on what you've been hearing, but also your insider knowledge here?
If I was put on the spot, I would think we could be talking tens of thousands of women, that sort of order of magnitude. And it's often the case where, you know, if we write a story and every time Tanya puts a story out, there's all the careful, thorough research behind the scenes, more women come forward. And you always know that they are just the tip of an iceberg, you know, the people who don't see the story or read it and don't think it applies to them. So I think we're just scratching the surface here. And one of the points I've made is every time we go to the government with a case, they say, oh, well, we'll fix that one case, that one lady's pension. And they don't ever stop and say, well, how many more people? Is there something systematic that we need to fix?
Well, that's a good point. Let's be fair. What have the Department for Work and Pensions been telling you?
On the whole, they say for some of these women, well, they should have made a claim. You know, these are generally the older women, perhaps in their late 70s. They'll say back in the day, before 2008, the rule was you didn't get this money unless you actually claimed it. And they even say, and we wrote to people. And of course, many of the women that we've corresponded with say, oh, I didn't get a letter. You know, if I'd had a letter from the government saying, would you like more pension, Mrs. Jones? I think I might have sent it back. So some of them just never knew about the claim. Others, it's just a computer cock-up, essentially, that it is quite obvious that these women automatically should have got the increase. It never happened. And in those cases, DWP will go back as far as it takes, add the money, and then Tanya and I often have to wrestle with them to try and get some interest on top. So it's quite a battle. And just the other thing, Georgie, is sometimes people ring up directly and they are fobbed off. They're told, no, nothing to see here, move along. And they come to Tanya or myself. We chase it and the government says, oh, yes, maybe there is something.
Fantastic work by both of you. Tanya, tell us the human impact. I mean, Steve's outlined the problem there, but you've been speaking to, as well, a lot of these women who are impacted. I mean, how long has this been going on for? How much money are we talking about? How is this impacting their lives?
Yeah, well, Steve's column went up at the end of January, and it's fair to say that I've interviewed a lot of women in their 70s over the last month, and I've also talked to their husbands and in some cases their adult children as well. They are bemused, they're flabbergasted really, that the government could have made such a huge error and got it some so wrong in their case. as time goes on, some of them are angry, as you might expect, when they hear about the payout, especially if they are suddenly told by me that they're getting 6,000, when they were told just 2 months ago that they, you know, weren't going to get anything. You know, they are excited. Sometimes I'm told, oh, that's fantastic. But one lady said, but what am I going to spend it on now? And I think that's, it's obviously a coincidence, but it's horrific timing. The very point that we're uncovering this, the women who are getting the payouts are very limited in what they can spend it on. There's also another aspect of this, which we haven't fully explored yet. We haven't had any cases where the woman involved has sadly died. But I think we're bound to get cases where people have already died. And although nobody's made it explicit to me when I've been speaking to them, these people are in lockdown and they're threatened with a really, really serious illness. I don't want to be alarmist about it, but maybe not the people I'm speaking to, but people out there who are worried about this may die before we get the DWP to carry out a full investigation. Now, we've asked them, but they've refused to respond as to whether if a woman's found to be underpaid, that her heirs would get the back payments that are now going out. They've completely failed to address this. I don't know whether Steve has any further idea about it, but I'm not sure that they would get the money.
It's a very unusual situation, isn't it? Because you'd be going back, and obviously in tragic circumstances. It seems to me, certainly on a moral basis, that if someone has been underpaid for potentially 10 years of pension, then their estate ought to get the money. But I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. We'll have to wait until we come across that situation. But certainly for some of them who claim, there are essentially two groups of women we're talking about. One is the ones who their husband turned 65 quite a long time ago, before March 2008. Those are the women who needed to actively make a claim for this uplift. And when they do now read the story in This Is Money, they make a claim. The government says, well, this is a new claim and you can only go back for 12 months. And they say, yeah, but I've been entitled since 2007. And the government says, no, this is a new claim, backdating for 12 months only. So these are the group we're particularly concerned about, who've been underpaid for a decade or more. And then the other group are the ones since 2008. So husband turned 65 since 2008. The computer should just have done this. They didn't need to make a claim under the law. They just get years and years worth of back money, which is great if we can get that. But it is mainly these older women who should have been, you know, who it turns out needed to make a claim. They didn't know. They didn't get a letter. And if we can do more for that group, perhaps through the Parliamentary Ombudsman or something, I'd be very keen to do that.
Tanya spoke there about coronavirus. How much do you think that this is going to impact on what has already been pretty poor response from DWP? I mean, how fast can they really investigate? How much is this going to be top of their priority list?
And to some extent, we could have just sat on this until everything was calmer. But of course, for the women who can only backdate for 12 months, every additional week that they don't make a claim is another week they've lost that they'll never get back. So that's why we thought long and hard about whether to go public on this. But it is urgent for these women. They do need to make a claim now. If the government were to say, okay, we're going to relax that rule, and therefore, you know, don't claim now, we're busy processing universal credit claims or something, ring us in the autumn. Well, you might accept that. If they would say that now, if they would say, we'll investigate, we will backdate, that would take the pressure off. But until they say that, and it's quite shocking, you know, some of these older women are on pensions of £50 a week or something. You wouldn't believe you can work all your life and get a pension of £50 a week. And that's what some of them are getting, and it's just not right.
Simon, just a word as editor about the work that Steve and Tanya have been doing.
Well, it's great that this kind of stuff is being picked up on and being flagged, because as Steve was saying, if you can get your pension uprated from £50 a week to substantially more, and you can get a lump sum, that can make a huge difference to people. But what I think is always concerning about cases like this is that what we've seen over many, many years is that when you get a series of emails, letters, people contacting you about a certain thing, it tends to be the tip of an iceberg. It tends to be the fact that if that number of people have bothered to get in touch with you, and it might seem like a relatively small number of people, it might be 10, a dozen, a couple, a dozen, but if those people have bothered to get in touch with you, you can guarantee that there are a multitude more out there who haven't got in touch. And this is true of any problem that we've seen, ranging from issues with people's pensions to when people are being defrauded in a certain way, to when people are struggling with a certain company that won't give them their money back. So to pull a couple of examples out of there, over the years, we've had the cases of people, this weird Wonga fraud that went on, where people were managing to take out Wonga loans in other people's names and then get the money paid into their bank account and then run off with it. Mm. We've had telephone fraud where people were phoning up pretending to be a person's bank. We've most recently had the airlines not refunding people the money for their cancelled flights for coronavirus. Now, when you get things like this and then you go to the companies involved or the organisations involved and you say, look, there's definitely a problem here. They say, no, it's just a couple of isolated incidents. We don't need to open an investigation into this. And they do, because if that number of people have got in touch with someone about it, you can guarantee, as I said before, there's lots more who haven't. So with this, I really do think that the DWP needs to open some form of proper investigation and work out what's going on and start systematically uprating people's pensions and giving them the money that they're owed, rather than waiting for individual cases to filter through. Now, I can understand why they do the latter option, because it saves them money and it's easier, but it's not the right thing to do. And I think that in this instance, it would be a good idea for the DWP, maybe when all this coronavirus stuff has finished, to pick up on the right thing to do.
And indeed, I think Simon makes a really important point there, which is that the DWP are sitting on all the information they need to do this. Because, of course, when we go to them with a case, they don't need to gather any further information from anybody else. They just look it up. They just look on their records. They check their records and say, oh yes, they should be getting more. So this tells you they already hold all this information. So for the people who should be getting it automatically, they just go to the computer, do a run and sign them. For the people who should have needed to make a claim, at the very least, they could contact them and say, we'll make a claim now, preferably ideally backdated. But they're holding all the cards. They potentially know all this information. It's just somebody having to decide to actually ask the question internally.
Steve, I'm going to ask you a difficult question, and it's made more difficult because of the environment that we're in, because we can't talk about hypothetical things, you know, that we would do if we don't take in the fact that actually this is a very difficult time and priorities need to be made, etc. But if you were pensions minister in this moment now, what would you be doing? What do you think the DWP should be doing? And bear in mind all the other issues related to pensions and work and pensions. Where does this sit?
It's fair to say that, you know, a lot of people, for example, who work on pensions in the DWP have no doubt been moved across to handle, you know, a million new universal credit claims and so on. And that's understandable and that's right. But to be fair, we started raising this before lockdown, you know, and to be frank, DWP have known about this issue on a case-by-case basis. You know, you just hear about odd cases over the years and it's a failure to investigate as they've gone by. It's not as if, you know, we've discovered something that they wouldn't have known about at a low level. But if I was in that place, there's still people working on pensions. They're still paying pensions. So it wouldn't be hard to do a computer run, first of all, for the people who should automatically have got this money. This is just a legal right. There's no debate about it. Do a run, see the scale of it and work out a plan for dealing with it. And then in my view, secondly, contact the people who need to make a claim. Those are the two proactive things they could do. And even if they just said to us, we will do this, but we can't do it for 3 months, I think we'd probably understand that. But simply saying, nothing to see here, move along, is just not good enough.
Daniel, Simon spoke about the number of people that come forward compared to the number of people that don't come forward. But what about the number of people that just have no idea? I mean, how can you check?
Whether you get owed some money depends on a few things that you need to check. Obviously, you need to be yourself being paid less than 60% of your husband's basic state pension. And that's the basic state pension, not including any of the second state pension and so on. Also, it obviously depends on what your husband is getting. So you have to check what his 100% figure is and find out 60% of that. But you also need to work out when he retired, because obviously that's when it should kick in. So when we ask people to get in touch with us about it, if they think we're affected, we ask them to give us all that information, the date of birth, and ask them to look at their annual state pension statements and give us as much information so that we can check the figures. So we've got a story about it. It's at the top of the pensions page on This Is Money at the moment, and it gives all the details that I've just explained. we are urging people obviously to contact the DWP themselves. It's the DWP who can sort this out for people ultimately, not us. We can't actually make the payments. But if people want to get in touch, all the information is there.
Final word to you on this one, Tanya. Send a message to DWP now. What would you be saying?
I think it's their duty to investigate this as soon as they can. We all understand about the COVID-19 crisis, but there are women in their 70s out there in lockdown who are discovering that they've been underpaid and they should be getting this money. It's really a scandal that they've been underpaid so long, and this has made a real impact, I think, on their retirement. Even if you're getting, say, £10 or £20 less a week, the amount of things that you haven't done over the years, the restaurants that you haven't gone to because you thought you probably couldn't afford a meal out, the slightly more modest presents that you bought for your grandchildren, the holidays that you haven't booked, you decided you wouldn't go to the US for a fortnight, you went on a short break to France instead because you didn't think you were the kind of family that could afford that kind of thing. You can't really fathom in individual cases what this has meant to people. But someone who suddenly got £9,000, which is what's happened in one case, they can't spend that now. They can't book the lavish holiday that they might want. It's heartbreaking, to be honest.
All right, I'm going to spread this out a little bit more broadly, looking at coronavirus's impact on pensions. We've covered a lot of other topics, but let's specifically go to pensions as we have you both here. We've had, as Simon's been talking about through podcasts past since lockdown, turbulence in the market, and a lot of people are questioning what on earth should they be doing at lots of different ages, particularly those people who are about to retire. So Steve, firstly, just outline for us the impact that this has all had on pension savers.
I think it's important to make the distinction between the two main types of pensions, the traditional final salary or defined benefit pensions and the newer pot of money defined contribution pensions. And on the final salary pensions, for most people, the chances are it won't make a lot of difference, because as long as their employer or former employer carries on trading, then their pensions will be fine, because the employer will go on putting money into the pensions, maybe not this quarter, but over the years, and the pensions will be paid. So there's some reassurance there, I think. If you've got a final salary type pension, you'll be okay. I should mention in passing, one reader of This Is Money wrote in recently and said, I've got a local government pension, which of course is absolutely cast iron guaranteed. Mm. And the reader said, but my kids are worried about it and have said I should cash out and buy gold. And you just think, crikey. So I think, they talk about them in gold-plated pensions, but I didn't take it that literally. So you know, you realise what people don't understand, you know, that these final salary pensions, by and large, you know, yes, there's some pressure, but should be fine. And there's a lifeboat pension protection fund if they're not. Obviously, it hits the people with pot of money type pensions much harder. It's a big slump in the stock market, although probably a third of that has come back already. So I think certainly for people a bit further away from pension age, just riding it out, it's easy to say, because, you know, some of the people who've written into the column have sort of said, I'm frightened it could go down further. Yes, if I sell up now, I've locked in my losses, but at least I know it won't drop any further. And I think that's quite a worrying, understandable, but worrying reaction. I think with people close to retirement, I know it's easy for someone like me to say, oh, I enjoy my work, I'm reasonably healthy. If you can work on a bit longer, if that is an option to think about, it can be transformative, because that means you could perhaps put on your state pension a bit later, so it would be bigger when you get it. Give you a bit more time to build back up your pension, a bit of money from your employer, a bit of investment return, and then the pot doesn't have to last quite so long in retirement. So if there is one thing that you can do, I think it is see if you can just go on putting in for that bit longer. It's not what you'd have chosen necessarily. That's probably the simplest bit of advice, I think.
Tanya, what have the government been saying in terms of advice or protections or support in light of coronavirus?
We have been getting something through from the pensions regulator. They've been talking to the employers that are paying final salary pensions and making certain adjustments to make life a bit easier for them at the moment. The people who are looking to cash out of final salary pensions, which is something that they shouldn't necessarily do, especially not in a panic in the middle of a pandemic, but they've got a new rule about, you know, you can wait an extra 3 months to get a valuation. So the official stuff that we're getting through has mostly come from the pensions regulator so far, I've got to say.
One of the things that I read with interest actually over the last couple of days that I didn't realise is that apparently a record number of UK adults are due to celebrate their 55th birthday this year. Now, 55 is the age at which you can first access your pension. I can see a gentleman indicating that he might be celebrating
his. I'm 55 in July.
Well, Steve, we all like to be unique, don't we? Unfortunately, you're in the peak 55 year, apparently. I've got the statistics here from an Aviva analysis of official population data, claims that almost 1 million people, or more than 18,000 every week, will reach 55. This year. Now, that is the age at which you can start accessing money in your pension. Now, if you don't need to access the money in your pension and you're going to be working for another 10 years or more, then it's probably not a great idea to go dipping into it, especially when the stock market is down substantially, as Steve was just talking about there. So, but what we have seen since pension freedom was introduced is a bit of a tendency for people to start taking some money out of their pensions at the age of 55. And there are other implications that are involved if you have a defined contribution pension from taking money out of it. For example, you can then put less money into it in the future. So I think that people do need to be wary about dipping in, and they maybe need to be thinking about using other pots of money perhaps before they dip into their pension. And Steve, I mean, you know more about this than I do, but there is a suggestion within the investment industry, isn't there, is that actually your pension is now the thing that you should spend last in retirement, and you should be using your ISA money instead, perhaps. Is that true, do you think?
Well, one of the arguments for leaving your pension till last is that there are very generous rules now on inheritance. So, for example, if you die before 75, your pension pot goes tax-free to your heir. So that's one reason. And, of course, if your pension's being invested for growth, you know, at 55, you know, as I say, I'm 55 this year. The statisticians would say on average I might live to my late 80s. Well, that's another 30 odd years. So you want to be investing for growth still in many respects. Whereas your ISA, you know, a lot of people got money sitting in a cash ISA paying 0. Not very much. So again, leaving your money where it's invested to grow rather than in a cash account seems to be sensible. And I think the other thing is, as Simon says, just because you can access your pension at 55 doesn't mean you should access your pension at 55. You know, it's designed, that freedom is designed mainly for those who are relatively well off, who've got other income and dip into their pension. But of course, we know that so many people aren't building enough up for their pension anyway. And if they then start accessing it 10 or 15 years before retirement, then they're storing up trouble for later.
This is the point, Steve, when we say goodbye and thank you very much. But can you remind us, if anybody has any questions or issues particularly related to our first story, how they can get in contact with you in terms of your pension column? We don't need your personal mobile number or anything like that.
Absolutely.
Might be a bit busy right now.
Every week we have plenty of readers sending in their questions by email through Pension Questions. They all go through the website. And then what I try and do is look through all the questions that have come in and try and find something interesting or something we haven't covered before. So, and it's great because if we do find an issue like the state pension one, occasionally we can take that up as a separate campaign. So it's great that so many readers of This Is Money take the trouble to contact us. I have to say, Tanya and colleagues do a fantastic job, often going the extra mile in response to people's queries. So keep them coming in.
Marvellous, Steve. Thank you so much. Right, so this is the point we say goodbye. Thank you very much to This Is Money Pensions Agony Uncle Steve Webb and, of course, to Pensions and Investment Editor Tanya Jeffries. If you have any more questions to them, please do email in. But Simon, I'm going to turn our attention to some other unsurprising but more gloomy news this week. The Chancellor warning we're facing a significant recession. The economy shrank by 2% in the first 3 months of 2020 as coronavirus forced the country into lockdown. It came the day Boris Johnson let people out of their homes and back to work or to the golf clubs, with caveats, of course, in a bid to get the economy back on its feet. Now, the housing market was also given the green light to get back to business. But one leading estate agent has forecast house prices will fall 7%, while the Bank of England predicts a 16% decline. So firstly, Simon, before we get our teeth into my favourite subject of house price predictions, firstly, the recession. as I said, not a massive surprise, and I won't go into what a recovery will look like. Listen back to previous episodes, UVL and all that jazz. But why is this particularly significant? It came a week after a scenario, not a forecast, by the Bank of England. It also said something pretty similar. In fact, lots of organisations are saying that this is bad, but really, you just have to look around you to know that this is going to have a significant impact on the economy. How bad could it be? Why does recession even matter? Why even the terminology? Why is this significant? Why does it matter?
A recession is officially two quarters of negative growth in a row. Negative growth is a wonderful economic term, which means that the economy is contracting rather than growing. And we measure it in GDP, gross domestic product, which is this sort of the sum total of all the stuff the country does. Is something of a flawed figure, actually, because there's an argument that you're better off using GDP per capita, so gross domestic product per head, how much each person produces, because you could actually just boost your GDP by getting a load of extra people into the country, and the country would not necessarily be any better off. You would just have more people producing more stuff. That's not an issue for the moment, though. The issue for the moment is that there has been a sharp contraction in GDP. The economy contracted 2% in the first quarter of 2020, which really doesn't sound that bad. In recessionary terms, say we had two quarters of 2% followed by 2%, it would be considered reasonably bad, but not awful. But of course, that first quarter of 2020 doesn't include lockdown, or the majority doesn't include lockdown. We went into lockdown on the 24th of March, so it's a week of it. People were already stopping doing stuff before that. So I think you could probably trace a serious economic slowdown to the middle of early first week of March, middle of March, something like that. But really through much of January and February, things were continuing as normal. This hit very, very quickly. So then you look at the figure for March, that was a 5.8% drop in GDP in that 1 month, the largest monthly fall on record. And this is going to continue to tick in because effectively we just pushed the pause button on the consumer economy as we know it. And so everybody was told to stay at home, shops were told to shut, businesses took this very, very seriously and said, right, we're going to get everybody to try and stay at home, we're going to try and look after people, the whole stay home, you know, save lives, protect the NHS message, all that kind of stuff. So everybody just stopped doing stuff. And actually, I think the government was surprised. They actually expected a little bit more activity than was going to go on. They expected less people to stop work. They expected more people to be still coming into work saying, well, I can't work from home. And they certainly, in something we're going to talk about after this, expected less people to be furloughed. So it's pretty bad. The Bank of England said last week it expects 14% to be wiped off UK GDP this year, the worst recession for three centuries. And then we had this sort of supposed leaked Treasury paper this week suggesting a £300 billion body blow to the UK from the enforced lockdown. And the suggestion, this was just a kind of thought piece for the Chancellor, but that there was going to have to be wide-ranging tax increases and spending cuts off the back of this. But Boris Johnson has already said that he has no intention of returning to austerity. And the big question of how we pay for all this still remains, which is something that we discussed in a bit of detail on the last podcast.
We did indeed. But I do want to talk to you a little bit about, you mentioned Boris Johnson there, the idea of getting people back to work. We got this week a little bit more indication, a roadmap, if you will, and the accompanying arguments that came with it between the home nations. It seems that there's not a huge amount of agreement, quite a lot of confusion, but people are heading back out. Good idea. Has the government got this right here?
I don't know. I suppose it all depends on whether you think this is just an evil Tory plan to make money, which a large number of people on social media seem to think it is. They just think it's evil Tories and all they care about is money and the economy.
Right.
People, there seems to be this argument put forward by some people that caring more about the economy than people's lives is completely wrong, and that any attempt to get out of lockdown, why we didn't go into lockdown earlier and everything, is just because we care more about the economy than we care about people's lives.
If you only take the view that a poor economy doesn't affect people's lives and even end people's lives to a degree.
Well, I think this is I think this is misguided, to be perfectly honest. I think people think about the economy in this abstract sense, but the economy is not an abstract. The economy, it's basically the collective output total of what we all do every day of our lives. It's the thing that we live in. It's the ecosphere. It's the bubble that we exist in. And it's a measure of what we do with our lives and how we spend them and our prosperity. And you can't set that against, they're not two completely separate things here. And if you see the economy shrink to this degree and the economy hammered to this degree, then it does affect people's real lives. I mean, we're going to be paying for this for years to come. Children's generation will be paying for this. It's taken some of the shine off our future, and some of that, you know, was necessary in order to protect people's lives. But there comes a point where you have to say, hang on, what are we going to do here? Because the only reason why this hasn't impacted people's lives and finance, if your finances are destroyed, then it has a serious impact on your life and a serious impact on your health.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Your physical and your mental health.
Huge.
And your well-being and your family's well-being, and it can wreck lives. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who never bounce back. There are people who never come back from it. The early 1990s recession was one of the most devastating recessions for people's lives, and there were people whose lives were completely changed by it and they never got themselves back on track. People should consider that kind of thing when they're going, oh, well, it's just caring about the economy more than people's lives. The economy is people's lives.
Absolutely.
And the only reason why this hasn't hit so much harder than it has is basically because of the furlough scheme. It's because the state is picking up 80% of people's wages up to £2,500 a month, which for the vast majority of people covers a lot of the money that they would be getting in. And so, and we've got 7.5 million people furloughed. So there's a lot of pain that's not being felt here at the moment. And maybe that's the right thing to do. Maybe that's the wrong thing to do. I can understand the logic of it, as we talked about last week, because the government wants the best chance we have of getting back up on our feet. But you've got to pay for that somehow. And we're borrowing, if you borrow money, you are effectively borrowing prosperity from your future. And that, unless we come up with some magical plan to clear the debt, that is exactly what we're doing at the moment. And that's why the government wants to get people back to work and get the country to kind of pick itself up a little bit more, because we can't be in the position that we were in a month or 5 weeks ago, when nobody was doing anything for a particularly long period of time, without it causing some real problems for many, many years to come.
I want to talk about, therefore, the furlough scheme. We'll get onto the housing market in a second, but you mentioned it because we got the announcement from the Chancellor this week that it would be extended 4 months until October. We had thought that there would be perhaps a cut in how much the government would be subsidising it. Well, it is 80 at the moment. We thought it might be 60. However, the Chancellor said no, the 80% would stay. But also he suggested that companies may be asked to share some of the burden. We'll get more details on the scheme later on this month. I guess the good news for getting people back to work, and this is part of the whole scheme of the furlough, is very quick to have a recovery that's quite quick. You want to have a workforce that's ready and up and ready to go, compared to, say, 2008, when that wasn't the case. People will be able to come back part-time from furlough from August. My instinct is why you don't do that a little bit sooner, but I presume that's because they're still working out some of the details of this. This has caused a bit of a split, I guess, in some people saying, I mean, you've outlined there that the furlough scheme is one of the reasons why we've managed to keep this going, you know, in terms of the economy. But also, the Chancellor himself has talked about weaning us off it. You don't want people not active, economically speaking, for a long time, and the bill, which is reportedly like a billion a day.
So the IFS has said that extending the furlough scheme in its current format up to the end of July is going to cost another £10 billion. They reckon that that is going to take the total cost for the job retention scheme, as it's officially called, up to £60 billion. The extension from July to October, we don't know the full details of what the part-time working element will be and how employers will be expected to pick up some of the bill. But total cost for this, Paul Johnson of the IFS reckons could hit £100 billion. That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. So therefore, how is this going to be worked out going forward? I outlined at the start of that there's going to be, or the Chancellor has suggested that there's the share of the burden. The idea of this whole scheme was so that we don't have mass redundancies. Are we just pushing it back? And we're going to get that anyway, but to the tune of billions and billions and billions of pounds that we've paid for it. Explain it to us, I suppose, in layman's terms of what the thinking is around this.
Well, this is the problem. And redundancy, you have a 45-day consultation period. The reason why this had to be extended now is because we were going to bump into that 45-day consultation period before the end of the furlough scheme, as was planned. The extension all the way to October was a bit of a surprise. I think what Rishi Sunak's trying to do is provide an element of certainty for both businesses and workers for a period of time, because if they only had an extra 2 months of certainty, there's not a lot of certainty. 2 months passes pretty quickly, as those of us looking down the barrel of 2 months in lockdown at the moment realize. But without that certainty, businesses will start to be thinking, well, maybe we should just plan to not have these people or half these people. We probably only need about half our staff. And workers will be thinking, this is great, but like, how am I going to pay my mortgage in 2 months' time and all those other things? October feels like a suitably long time away. And bearing in mind that we had the government announcement and path out of lockdown mapped out earlier this week, but it was extremely vague, and Boris's speech was short on concrete detail, because they don't know the concrete detail, because it all kind of depends on what happens. And, you know, we've now got this new 5-level alert risk, which, as far as I can see from my own personal experience, has been stolen from avalanche warnings when you're snowboarding and skiing. But, you know, those avalanche warnings do work relatively well. So we don't really know. And that means that they don't really know. And so that's why they've tried to just kick the can down the road a bit. But the longer you kick the can down the road, the more it costs you, which is why employers are going to be expected to share some of the burden. And they want to try and get people back part-time. Yeah. The part-time thing was a worry because they think it's open to abuse. Employers will claim on the furlough scheme for them for their workers' wages and then get their workers to work full-time. Whereas pretty at the much. Moment, yeah. they're not allowed to do any work. And that's just much easier to police. But I think in terms of weaning themselves off it's the best thing to do, this part-time. But then now employers are slightly concerned that all of a sudden from August, they're going to be on the hook for paying staff not to work.
Yeah, I think the other thing the issue is as well, though, hopefully, like you said, the government don't know, and maybe we'll get a better picture in the next couple of months. Who knows? But because we had the extension of the furlough scheme, we had the opening of the self-employment scheme. There's also the mortgage payment holidays, which are likely to come to an end. Are we going to see extensions, guarantees on those as well?
Maybe. The self-employed are having to wait quite a long time for their money. And a lot of
if you're entitled to it at all.
Well, a lot of the self-employed aren't getting any money at all. Yep. And that's been painted as only the wealthy self-employed, but that's not true at all. There's lots of very normal people who are self-employed and support their families on over £50,000 a year and get not a penny.
Yep.
Whereas people on the furlough scheme get 80% up to, you know, £2,500. But I do think that maybe we'll see an extension of the mortgage holidays. Maybe it'll just be up to banks and building societies to do it. I mean, effectively, the government...
Which they did anyway in the past, right?
Yeah, the government can now kind of leave it to the banks and building societies. And it's not in the bank and building societies' interest to repossess a load of people
yeah.
and crash the housing market. Because if they repossess those properties, they're going to have to sell them and there's not going to be anybody to buy them. And they'll just lose more money on the properties. But I think we'll probably see an extension of that with the self-employment thing. I guess it depends on how we see, how many people we see go back to work with this whole, if you can't work from home, do go back to work thing.
Just a quick one on that one. It does seem, you must have seen the tubes and all that sort of thing. It does seem extraordinary that we've had this sort of announcement to go back to work without much more sort of strict rules enforcements. It's sort of like, yes, you should be advised to wear masks, and I'm not saying you should or shouldn't. I would have imagined that perhaps more things would have been brought in, like they have in supermarkets where you can't go to certain checkouts, etc., which would have happened on public transport to have got us perhaps ready, perhaps more guidance for companies. Did I miss that memo?
Well, I think we're seeing a bit of a problem with the battle between the government and Sadiq Khan and Transport for London, really, aren't we? In that Transport for London is independent of the government and ultimately controlled by the mayor. And they're not running a lot of their services because they say that they don't have the staff. And the government wants them to run more services so that people can socially distance on the tubes. But Transport for London has got a massive hole in its budget. Because people haven't been using the tubes and the buses, and therefore Transport for London is not getting the revenue in, and it wants the government to bail it out, and the government doesn't want to bail it out, and yeah, so
yeah. Well, not, look, you
it seems that a bit stupid to get caught up in a disagreement like that in the middle of all of this, but you know, that's life, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned there about mortgage holidays, who will buy, but we did have the green light back to the housing market to kind of get that cranked up and going. What were the changes and what impact is it going to have?
Good news, folks. The property market is open for business. It is back in business. And if you listen to some estate agents, it is going really well. I'm not entirely sure how many people are going to be buying any houses, and certainly how many are going to be buying any houses at the same price that they would have been buying a house at the start of February. Some agents seem to think that this is not going to be a problem at all, but I don't know. It's got my suspicions that chart of GDP falling through the floor, those 7.5 million people furloughed, the 2 million more people claiming unemployment benefits, and so on, might have some form of impact on all of this, but you never know.
Possibly.
But basically, when the announcement was, when Boris did his speech on Sunday, and when the exit plan came through on Monday, estate agents were there going, what about us? What about us? Like, and it's like, well, you're not essential. You can't go back to at least June the 1st. And then all of a sudden, the government suddenly rushed out this announcement. Tuesday night, 10 o'clock. It was embargoed till 10 o'clock. Property markets reopened immediately. I don't know like how much of it reopened at 10 o'clock on Tuesday night. I think a lot of it reopened Wednesday morning. It actually caught... the best bit of this is it caught loads of the estate agents by surprise. There's loads of estate agents who were like, yeah, we just totally didn't know this was coming. It would have been nice to have a bit of warning.
Just a quick one. So I've been trying to investigate, and I went to HMRC. What sort of notice period do people have who've been furloughed to come back? They said, we don't really, there's no strict guidance on it. So you can literally at 10 o'clock at night go, look, the government's made an announcement. Get at your desk tomorrow at 8 o'clock.
Ah, no.
Or not.
No. That depends what you wrote into your agreement with your furloughed employee when you furloughed them.
If you don't, absolutely.
There is no official furlough agreement. So a company, when it furloughed its member of staff, should have come to an agreement. The minimum amount of time you could furlough someone for was 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It could be different time periods. And companies should have put in there a clause that says, we could get you back to work with X amount of notice. No notice whatsoever.
Yeah.
If they haven't, and they tell you to come back to work, and you refuse to come back to work, they could theoretically claim that your contract of employment, under which you're still employed, means that you have to come back to work, and they could threaten you with the sack. But if they did sack you, and they hadn't written anything into the furlough agreement, they could end up with an unfair dismissal claim. Whereas if they had written in there that you could be recalled from furlough with X amount of notice and you then refuse to go back, you could get sacked for not going back.
Hey,
so estate agents, going back to what you were saying, are an industry that have furloughed a lot of people, right? So there's a lot of people working for state agents going, I thought I was furloughed. The directors that are going to be very, very busy over the next few days and then probably be getting their staff back. So up until now, agents weren't allowed to go to properties to do valuations, to do photos, to do floor plans. They weren't allowed to conduct viewings in person. You could do online stuff. So they could have theoretically sold a home if someone viewed it online and made an offer, but a few have made sales, but not many. Surveyors couldn't go around and do valuations, which was a big problem for the mortgage industry and so on, and anybody wanted a building survey. Now, all of those things are allowed to be done again. So an estate agent, you can call up an estate agent, say, I'm thinking of selling my home. The estate agent can come around, they can have a look at your home. They can take some photos, they can do the floor plans, they can list your home for sale. They can have people come round and view your home, and then they can accept an offer. Once your offer's made, you can instruct a surveyor. They can come around and do a building survey. The mortgage company can send a surveyor around. So theoretically, it's all back up and running, but it's not business as usual. Government has recommended online viewings where possible, social distancing, strict social distancing in place. The owners have to be out when you're viewing the home. Can't have more than two people in there. Various bits and bobs that mean that it's not just going to go back to business as usual. Never mind the bit where people are going to be extremely wary about this. And Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors this morning said 80% of its member agents had reported sales falling through during lockdown.
So therefore, my favourite subject, which I think is even better than house prices, is house price forecast. 7% one leading estate agents told us is money, and the Bank of England predicting a 16% decline. Is it going to be a case of we just don't know? Or having set out what you set out, even with these sort of green lights and measures to get back to business, you've got a whole host of issues, not excluding people's sentiment. If people are worried about their jobs, worried about getting payments, who's going to want to think about moving or taking on if you can avoid that?
Yeah, so this is an issue that is going to crop up and nobody really knows. And you're probably going to have a load of people rushing properties onto the market, thinking that if they can get in and get an offer in quickly, they'll manage to get it sold before the price drops start to come through and be reported in the indices and in the press. And there'll probably be some agents advising people, if you want to sell, act now, take the first good offer you get, because it's only going to get worse. Knight Frank revised its forecast from a fall of 5% to a fall of 7% and said actually most of that fall has probably already happened. Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, 40% of its members saying that they expect the property market to reopen at least 4% down. It's not like the stock market. It's very difficult to measure these things. Bank of England, in its financial stability report alongside its monetary policy report last week, said 16% fall due to coronavirus. We've had Lloyds saying 5% fall, 10% worst case scenario. Economists at CEBR said 13%. Savills has said 5 to 10%. Nobody really knows. What the widespread suggestion is that it would be highly unlikely to come out of this without house prices, which, let us remember, were already pretty high compared to people's wages in most places, falling, because one side of that equation, the wages side, has definitely taken a hit for many people. And certainly the sentiment side, the bit where people are willing to pay a higher multiple of their wages. You know, if you think of it like a price to earnings ratio in the stock market, the sentiment has been dented as well, because people think future prospects aren't so good.
So in sum, it's like everything else. We just don't know what's going to happen. So that lady, the estate agent that was saying we're going to be back up and running and booming and the summer's going to be unprecedented. You know, I like positivity, but we think that might have been a step too far.
That's true. And that's Lucy Pendleton of James Pendleton Estate Agents. But Lucy Pendleton has achieved what I believe that was meant to achieve. And that is lots of coverage in the press being quoted places and featured on programs and saw her on the news the other night. So it's, you know, there's something to be said for
you didn't optimism. Have to mention her there. You know, we could have just left that. It didn't have to be
I didn't, did I? Yeah. Right. Silly. Look, I tell you what, a read across from, for the, read across from fund manager Nick Train of Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust. I wrote my column about his latest note to investors, in which he reflected upon the coronavirus crisis. And having been around the block a few times in a 39-year investing career, he said the last 6 months have been the most distressing he's experienced. Wow. Lots of people have asked him, you know, to draw on his wisdom of the past. And he said, basically, of him and his fellow manager, Michael Linsall, we know enough to know that we don't know.
Yeah, we'll steal that, I'm sure, in the future. You can keep up to date. That's it for now. Thank you very much to everybody that was involved in today's show. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And if you bought or sold a home during lockdown, email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and tell us all about it.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.